Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Democrat Chris Pappas began his first term as New Hampshire's first district congressman in January, and he's among the Democrats serving as a check to a Republican Senate and president. Today on The Exchange, we're going to catch up with Congressman Pappas, and your questions are welcome. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477 if you've got a question or a comment for him. Again, that's 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, and you can also comment on our Facebook page, which is where you can watch a live video of this conversation happening at NHPR Studios. Just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook. That's all one word, NHPR Exchange. And Congressman Pappas, welcome to The Exchange. Great to see you.
Good morning, Peter. Great to be with you today.
So let's talk about some of the big issues happening in Congress now. Among them, of course, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. He released his report on Russian election interference in 2016. Last time we spoke, it had just come out. You've read a bit more of the report since then. What are your thoughts as you reflect on what you're reading?
There's deeply concerning information within that report, and that's why I think it's critically important that Robert Mueller appear before a congressional committee in a public setting to answer questions. One of the things that I've been very dismayed at is the way the administration has tried to muddy the waters around the release of the report, and the attorney general has been running point on that. He's been acting as a mouthpiece for this administration, and I think it's important that we set the record straight, and we can only do that, I think, if we hear from Mueller very clearly and directly and are able to question him in an open setting. The report has a couple of major sections. The first deals with Russian interference in the 2016 election. And while Mueller found that there was direct communication between the Trump campaign and Russian interests, he didn't feel that there was this non-legal term collusion between the campaign and the Russians. But the interference that existed was real. And they spent money on advertising. They hacked the emails and servers of the DNC, the DCCC, and other organizations who were supporting Hillary Clinton for president. They released that information in a way to, really damage the campaign. And the Trump campaign knew exactly what was happening almost every step of the way. So it's deeply concerning what's happening. And when you have a problem like that, which is a problem for our democracy and in future elections, the first step is recognizing that you have a problem. And this administration seems unwilling to do that and to take the steps necessary to protect ourselves from further meddling in the future from Russia or other foreign interests. The second section of the report deals largely with obstruction of justice. And Mueller was very clear that there was evidence there, but that he was not making a formal recommendation. He certainly was not exonerating the president from obstruction. And so that's why I believe Congress has more work to do to unpack this report and to make sure that it sees the light of day, that the American people can get a full assessment of what's transpired. Very concerning questions that need to be answered. This president operates like no other president in history. He flouts the law, flouts the conventions of our democracy. And I think it's really important that he doesn't set a precedent for future presidents to be able to conduct themselves in a similar fashion.
As you mentioned, Special Counsel Robert Mueller sort of walked up to the line of obstruction of justice, but didn't sort of cross it and say that the president, in fact, had. But he did kind of leave a roadmap, if you will, for Congress, for people like you. So where does that roadmap lead? Does it lead to impeachment? Is impeachment a thing that should happen?
as I said, I think there are next steps that need to happen, and one of them is get Mueller in front of a congressional committee. I also think that Attorney General Barr needs to appear, as well as Don McGahn.
So you're not willing to go as far as say yes to impeachment just yet?
Well, I think that we can't make this a political process, and we can't decide.
But isn't it, though? Isn't it a political process right from the beginning? If there's no actual criminal charges, that Congress needs to decide whether or not there is political will to remove the president?
Well, I think it's a very sober constitutional bar that you have to clear in order to consider and find reason that the president has committed impeachable offenses. And so that process needs to continue to move forward. I think that it shouldn't be done for political purposes. It shouldn't be avoided for political purposes. And so I think we've got to try to take a very rational view of this. As I said, get more testimony from the players. And I think that the committees of jurisdiction in Congress, which I'm not a part of, have some digging to do here in the coming weeks. Mm-hmm. We can't let this hang out there any longer over the horizon than necessary, because we have such important work to do in Congress on a variety of critical issues. That work continues to go forward. But to the extent that we're still having the conversation about the Mueller report and what Mueller meant by his findings, that in the media at least is going to crowd out the work that we're doing on prescription drugs and healthcare and infrastructure and the important issues that we need to find consensus on for the American people.
All of which we're going to talk about in this hour, by the way. And listeners, if you have questions about those issues, give us a call. We'll put you in the queue and bring you in when we start talking about it. The number 1-800-892-6477. So, Congressman Pappas, it seems like you're calling for a little more investigation, or maybe even a lot more investigation, before any conclusion can be made on whether or not impeachment is the right thing to do. But can I ask you about what specifically you hope to uncover in these investigations? Because the argument from the president's supporters is that, you know, these investigations are all motivated by presidential harassment. So what specifically would you like to uncover in calling, for example, Robert Mueller to testify or anybody else to testify with respect to possible obstruction of justice or Russian collusion?
Well, Congress has the power to call witnesses, to subpoena individuals, and to get testimony on the public record. And I think in the way that Barr has muddied the waters and tried to confuse the findings of the report, clarity is required at this point in time. Sunlight is the best disinfectant that I know of. And that's why it's critically important that Congress and the Article I branch of government step up to the plate and ensure that we're functioning the way our founders intended us to. There's a natural tension that was created within our government between the executive and the legislative branch. And I know that makes this administration in particular pretty uncomfortable to know that there are others that are providing a check and a balance. But it is really essential that we do that, as I said, that we do it in a non-political way. And so I think the committees of jurisdiction in the House in particular have a job to do in the coming weeks to make sure that we unpack the findings of the report and put it all out on the table.
So I don't think anyone's disputing the fact that the House does have a right to ask for this kind of information or this testimony or subpoena things. But the question is, what exactly are you looking for? Is this more than just a fishing expedition?
It's absolutely not a fishing expedition. Okay. People need to have confidence in their government. They need to know that their president did not commit obstruction. And if he did, there needs to be consequences for those actions. No one is above the law, including the president of the United States. I know that some, including the attorney general, may have a difference of opinion on that in terms of what charges might be lodged against the president. But as I said, I think Congress has an important constitutional role to play here. And we can do that while still focusing on the needs of the American people, which I hear about each and every day when I'm back here in the district.
Mm-hmm. What about those who defy congressional subpoenas and don't show up when you ask them to testify? Is this, if given the chance, would you vote to hold someone in contempt of Congress for not showing up when you ask them to show up?
That's part of the purview of Congress, and I think that
should be— would you vote to hold them in contempt?
I think that should be used if there's a compelling reason and interest for that individual to appear before Congress and answer questions, and if they're stonewalling or not complying with that request. It's very essential for us to be able to understand what's been transpiring, to have individuals on the public record, and Congress has the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. Have you met with the president in person?
You know, I've been in the same room as him a couple of times over the last several months, but I haven't met with him in person. I think if I did have the opportunity to talk with him, I would tell him about the opioid crisis that continues to rage in New Hampshire. I'd talk to him about the struggles of some of our Main Street businesses, especially as they look to recruit and train workers. I would talk to him about the groundwater pollution that we're seeing in communities across our state. So there's a lot that I'm focused on, and I'm willing to work with the president on anything where I think he can be a constructive partner.
You've mentioned Attorney General William Barr sort of muddying the waters a bit with respect to the Mueller report. Should he be held in contempt of Congress for not showing up when he should have?
I believe he should. And I think that, you know, as the head of the Department of Justice, there's no reason he should be avoiding talking to Congress or appearing before a committee to answer questions. That's his job.
Let's move on to some other things. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. Congressman Pappas, you've been in office since January, and during your campaign you said that Washington was broken. You wanted to help forge bipartisan agreements in Congress. Maybe one thing to say when you're running or just starting out, 7 months in now, how hopeful are you that Congress can be, quote-unquote, fixed?
Well, I'm thankful to be serving in a space that is a lot more collaborative than you might expect, given how the media covers Congress. I have two major assignments in terms of committees. I'm on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. I'm also on the Veterans Affairs Committee. And in both of those spaces, we're working together very well. We understand the challenges, and we're working together as Americans, not necessarily as Republicans and Democrats. So I really appreciate the ability to do that, and I think you know, if any committees are going to show some wins over the next couple years, it'll probably be those two. But there is division that exists. I believe that, you know, we saw it last week where we had an important bill on disaster relief, and one individual who held some pretty extreme views decided to object and prevented the necessary aid going forward to farmers and communities impacted by hurricanes and wildfires. It's those types of, you know, political decisions that can really gum up the works in Congress. And I think we've got to keep our eye on the ball. I think if there was any message sent in the 2018 elections, it was that, you know, Washington doesn't produce the way voters expect it to, that we have problems. We have a very clear path forward, but yet we don't see enough results. And I'm hoping that we can break that logjam. I know in the House we've passed more than 120 pieces of legislation already in the first 4 months of our session. But we also see on the other side of the House, in the Senate, only about a dozen of those bills have been taken up by Mitch McConnell and the Republican Senate. And so we do find ourselves in a divided government. And I think it is incumbent upon us to, while we may disagree, find those areas of commonality where we can push forward solutions, be it on infrastructure or issues that impact our veterans or other solutions that are important to people of New Hampshire.
Well, can you point to an example of a bipartisan solution that you have found with your fellow lawmakers in the past few months?
Sure. There are a number that we have pushed forward through the House Veterans Affairs Committee, one dealing with child care, for instance, for our veterans who are seeking care at the VA. You know, it's really important that we look at some of the solutions that were pushed in the last Congress and how we implement them this year so that they're having the intended effects. We all understand that we're facing a crisis of veteran suicide in this country, where we lose 20 veterans each and every day to suicide. And our committee has held a hearing on that. We've seen a number of bills that seek to address that and look for ways to make sure we're doing the outreach we need to veterans who aren't getting care in the VA system and who are seeing an even higher rate of suicide. So we have a lot of work to do in that space, and that's one place, I think, where we can continue to see bipartisan solutions.
One of the first things you encountered when you started your first term here was the government shutdown, the very long government shutdown that did come to an end. What did you learn from that experience?
I learned it's important to get everyone in a room and to keep people talking. The way it ended was that the appropriators from the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats, got in a room and they hashed it out. And that's exactly what they were trying to do in December. They had reached a deal, and then the president blew it up at the 11th hour. So it's really important that we continue talking to one another. I think that's how we can find solutions. I hope that folks learned the lesson from the longest government shutdown in American history, that that's not an appropriate tactic to use to legislate or, you know, to try to get things done in Washington, D.C. You shouldn't be hijacking the government to prove a political point. Let's make sure we, you know, deal with the budget, that we fund government appropriately, And then let's air our differences on other issues, but don't hold the whole process hostage, including hundreds of thousands of federal workers who weren't getting paid or who were furloughed and being used as political pawns, essentially, in that process. So I hope we don't go there again. I hope we can come up with a, fully funded, year-long appropriation for all the departments of government by the deadline later this year, and that we don't get into these continuing resolutions where we kind of kick the can down the road and set ourselves up for, the kind of shutdown politics that too often have reared its ugly head.
I want to shift gears and ask you about something that's been in the news in other states, and protests about it have happened here in New Hampshire as well, and that's Alabama's very restrictive abortion law. Near total ban on abortions, very restrictive. Other states have moved to do similar restrictions. Is this a war on women, as some Democrats claim?
I mean, I think it's a war on women's choice. It's a war on women's health. And I believe that we've got to fight back against it, be it at the federal and state level.
Well, how would we fight back on the federal level? What could be done in Congress? What should be done in Congress, if anything?
Well, I, for one, believe that a woman should be able to make her own reproductive choices. And I believe that that is supported by the Roe v. Wade decision. I also think we need a belt and suspenders approach at this point in time. And so I would.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I believe that we have a prevailing court decision that gives women a constitutional right to seek that kind of care. But we also have a Supreme Court that has been remade over the last couple of years. And there are questions about, how Roe will be chipped away at as some of these laws make their way up through the legal system to the Supreme Court. So I think that, Congress should pass a law guaranteeing women the right to reproductive choice. And I think states should do that as well to make sure that women are protected. It's really essential to ensure that people lead healthy, productive lives, that they have the economic security that comes with choice.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the 2020 campaign season. We're now at 23 Democrats running for Congress. In your view, is this a good thing to have so many people running for president?
Well, as someone who went through a big primary last year, we had 11 in our congressional primary. I think it's part of the times where people want to be a part of the discussion. There's a lot of excitement around individuals who are seeking the presidency. They're getting big crowds here in New Hampshire. I think voters have their list, and they're looking to, meet their top 5 or 10 choices before they make up their mind. So I think the race remains really fluid. But I don't think we're hurt by there being a lot of voices in the discussion, because ultimately, if Donald Trump is going to be replaced in 2020, we're going to have to ensure that there's the strongest Democratic nominee possible who can build the broad coalition we need to win. And ultimately, that's what it's going to come down to: who can go the distance, who's got what it takes. And here in New Hampshire, we have a better shot than anywhere else in the country of figuring that out. So I think voters here are going to suss that out over the next several months.
What's your involvement, if any, with candidates coming through New Hampshire? Are you introducing them? Are you taking them places?
Well, I have 4 House colleagues who are running for president, which is unusual. Our senators have Senate colleagues as well who are running. I think we all, in terms of the delegation, are looking for ways to be a good ambassador for the primary, to talk with these candidates when they call, and they do call. They always ask about.
So you're talking with them, but not necessarily appearing with them in public?
Yeah,
at this point?
I haven't done any public appearances really with the candidates. I think it's important that the voters are out in front of this primary, but also that the candidates are understanding the culture of our state. How to do it right, what issues are important to the people of New Hampshire. And if they put in the time, if they build a really authentic campaign and are looking for ways to connect with the people of New Hampshire, I think they're going to rise to the top. And, New Hampshire's always thrown a few curveballs in the past in terms of our primary, where we like to upend expectations. And I think that'll probably happen again.
Mm-hmm. So what are you looking for in a Democratic nominee?
Well, I think it's important to have a nominee who has some solid experience under their belt, who can appeal to a broad range of voters, especially, voters in the middle. We have a lot of independent voters here in New Hampshire. 40% to 45% of voters are independents. They pick and choose based on the individual, not based on the party. So we have to talk directly to their needs. So I think it's got to be a candidate who is solutions oriented, who can demonstrate an ability to build a coalition and to win.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a short list of among the 23 candidates on the Democratic side?
No, I have a pretty long list. So, you know,
we'll 23 candidates long?
We'll figure this all out. I think there's some really important voices that are part of the chorus in the primary, and we'll see how it all shakes out. I would believe that 23 won't make it to primary day in New Hampshire, but that of the number that do, you know, New Hampshire will winnow the field a little bit more beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Are there any lessons to be learned from the last Democratic primary, from Senator Sanders' victory over Hillary Clinton in 2016? Any lessons that we should keep in mind as we head into 2020?
Well, I think it's important that, you know, the primary remains civil, that we look for ways to stay together, and that once all is said and done and once the dust settles, that there be unity behind the nominee. I think from my experience in the House these past few months, what I've appreciated is that there is strength in numbers, particularly during the shutdown fight, where we were unified on the point that shutdown politics are wrong and that the president shouldn't be able to close down the government to get his way on the wall that Congress and the American people don't support. So I think there's a similar reason for us to stick together and be strong at a point in time where I believe we're facing an existential threat in the White House, and we need to look for ways to repair our democracy and make sure that average working class Americans are getting a fair shake in Washington.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking today with Congressman Chris Pappas. What questions do you have for him about Congress, legislation that exists or, in your view, should exist? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We've got lots more to talk about on domestic policy after a break. This is NHPR.
New Hampshire Public Radio listeners are curious, civically minded, and digitally savvy. As an NHPR underwriter, your business or organization can connect to this statewide and engaged audience through our many podcasts, our e-newsletter, or at our award-winning news site, nhpr.org. Learn more by visiting the business support page at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with Democratic Congressman Chris Pappas from New Hampshire's 1st District. In this part of the program, we'll be speaking about a variety of domestic policies, and your questions or comments are welcome. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. If you'd rather not call, you can send an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Congressman Pappas, let's talk about environmental issues. Some have called climate change a national emergency. How high is climate change on your list of priorities?
It is a national emergency. It's a threat to our national security. And it's the most pressing international issue that we face. And we've got to be a part of the conversation. That's why the House recently passed H.R. 9, a bill that would put us back into the Paris Agreement. The administration wants to pull us out, although that decision doesn't take effect until just after the next presidential election. So there's time to do a course correction there. But what's really fascinating to me is that people are making the changes necessary in their own households, in their own businesses, in their own communities. That is not matched by an effort at the federal level to be moving in that direction, where we could really impact the conversation and implement the change that needs to happen. We're facing a very urgent threat. And I believe that by 2050, we need to decarbonize our economy and ensure that we are developing our energy portfolio from renewable sources, that we're more efficient in the transportation sector, and that we're looking for ways to help solve this. America can be a leader in this space, but right now we're falling behind. And in fact, we have an administration that is rolling back critical environmental protections. They've undermined the Clean Power Plan that is polluting the air over New Hampshire, and they're looking for more ways to weaken environmental regulations in a way that's going to, you know, increase emissions and increase pollution. I just think that's the wrong direction to go in. So we need to be really thoughtful about how we proceed here. And I'm hopeful that this issue will get the attention it deserves through the 2020 election.
Is there any particular angle you as a congressman would like to take to address issues of climate change and the environment? For example, like incentivizing individual behavior. So people, for example, weatherize their homes or drive more efficient cars. That's just an example. Don't want to lead you in any particular direction, but that's kind of what I'm getting at. Is there something Congress can do to incentivize behavior?
Absolutely. So one of the things we're thinking about as we look at an infrastructure bill is creating the spine of charging station that we need to make sure that we incentivize more people to drive electric vehicles.
Not just Tesla, but other kinds as well?
Yes, absolutely. So you know, all makes and models of electric vehicles and encourage more to be produced. The transportation sector actually causes more emissions in this country than the energy sector does by a small amount. And so that's a space where I think our committee can be helpful at making sure that we have the infrastructure we need to support the change that needs to occur. We also need to be thoughtful about how we fund infrastructure. And one of the things we're facing right now is the fact that the gas tax has less and less buying power as we drive more fuel-efficient vehicles. So we have to think a little bit about how we make sure that there's stable funding for states to do projects and to plan for the future.
A possible raising of the gas tax?
Well, that's one of the things on the table. But another thing that's being promoted is vehicle miles traveled, so that regardless of how you power your vehicle, you're going to be paying something toward the maintenance and improvement of the transportation network.
So being taxed by the miles you drive and not the drops of gas you burn.
That's one of the proposals that's out there. And also thinking in that committee space about how we create a resilient infrastructure to ensure that it can respond to the rising sea levels, the increasing storms that we're seeing. That's a very real problem that we're facing. We don't have a very good inventory of culverts in New Hampshire, and a lot of them aren't able to handle the type of stormwater that we're seeing on an increasing basis. So that's a space where we need to do a better job planning. And as we reconstruct and build for the future, we need to take into consideration how the changing climate comes into play. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I think in the energy space, we should be incentivizing renewables. We should pull away all our support for fossil fuels and make sure that we're ushering in the change that needs to happen to develop more solar, wind, geothermal, and biomass in this country. I support making sure that those tax incentives are in the right place so that people make that decision.
We got this question from Laura. She wrote in to say, climate scientists tell us we have 12 years left to prevent catastrophic climate change. Yet utilities in New Hampshire are still planning pipelines to expand use of climate warming fracked gas. What will you do to prevent further investment in fossil fuel infrastructure?
Well, as I said, I think we need to be working to leave fossil fuels in the rearview mirror. And that's why I think we need to put the incentives in the right place in terms of our tax code, in terms of, the giveaways that exist for the oil and gas industry.
So tilting the market in favor of renewable sources?
I think so, because the technology is rapidly advancing. And if we make sure that, we put the incentives in the right place, we're going to see a point in time where renewables are outpacing old technologies like fossil fuels and creating the future and the right energy mix we need to be leading on this as a nation.
You've supported efforts to look closely at the Green New Deal. Can you talk a little bit about what in the Green New Deal you like at this point?
So I supported the creation of a select committee in Congress to deal with climate change. And they're going to be coming up with a flurry of policy proposals to allow us to grapple with this and to allow us to address this in a more coherent fashion. That's one proposal that's out there. And I think what the Green New Deal gets right is the sense of urgency that we all need to have as we face this problem. We don't have a lot of time to be able to leave an impact on this or to stave off the very most catastrophic results from climate change. And so we do need to act today. And I think we need to act in a way that understands that this is not, a false choice between supporting economic growth and our economic future and supporting the environment. There is significant cost in not doing anything, in just letting this all play out and letting the really most severe effects of climate change from hitting New Hampshire is going to be far worse for us economically and in terms of, you know, budgets at the federal and state level than if we work to try to reorient the way we derive our power and we fuel our vehicles. And so I think that's the change we have to begin to usher in.
Mm-hmm. So you agree with the sense of urgency that the Green New Deal sort of spells out sort of as part of the, when you take all its policy proposals as a whole, because they are quite sweeping. But is there any number of those things spelled out in the Green New Deal, the ambitious projects that you feel are, yes, that's a green light, let's pursue that?
You know, I look at the, you know, the way that we can talk about infrastructure and climate change and jobs in the same space as a good approach. I think we should be not just looking at, you know, proposing some new environmental regulations, but talking about how we can create the good-paying jobs of tomorrow to make sure that our economy and our climate are pointed in the same direction.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Mark in Cornish. Mark, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hey, my question is, and I'm going to just leave it there so they can hear the answer, is in the past in this country, we've always let the market, free market economy, take care of things like this. If people want to participate in clean energy, they'll go that way on their own instead of having Congress give incentives that we're all going to pay for in the long run. I'm just wondering why you think you know more about this solution than the people of New Hampshire and the country.
Mark, thanks for the call. Congressman Pappas, your response.
Thanks for the call. I do believe that, you know, there are experts that know a great deal about this, and the science is pretty clear on this, that if we don't act in a meaningful way in the short term, we're going to see some pretty serious long-term impacts. And so I do believe in markets, but I also believe that markets themselves can't solve this problem, that we need to ensure that we have good, sensible policies in place that are going to lead us down the right path. And as I said, we need to be part of the world community on this. We can't just bury our heads in the sand. We need to be working on the international stage with partners from around the world, including from those countries that are still developing, that have the potential to pollute a lot more than the United States, to make sure that they're reining in their emissions too.
Mm-hmm. Recently, you held a listening session on a water contamination in Merrimack. What did you learn there?
Well, there are a number of residents in that community and so many other communities around the state that have been focusing on this for a period of years. And the pollution in Merrimack is real. There are a number of households that are still on bottled water that haven't been connected to a clean public water source. Individuals have questions about, you know, their own consumption and exposure. You know, how do they, you know, bathe their kids? How can they run their household when they're connected to a water source that, frankly, you know, contains high levels of PFAS and has the potential to cause long-term chronic conditions? So there's deep concern. These individuals deserve answers, and I believe that we should give individuals access to blood testing and to better public health information. We need to be also holding the EPA to account. They have a prevailing advisory that appears to be about 10 times higher than is appropriate given new science that's come out. So we need to ensure that a maximum contaminant level is set that's appropriate, that's going to protect the public health of individuals in our state. So I learn a lot from these types of meetings. It gives me ideas on the legislative front. We have a working group in Congress that's dedicated to PFAS issues. It's made up of Republicans and Democrats from a variety of states. Some states are seeing this more acutely than others, and there are reps from Michigan and Pennsylvania that have seen quite a bit of industrial pollution, similar to what we see in Merrimack. But just about every former military base you look at is going to have PFAS contamination, PFAS and groundwater adjacent to it because of firefighting foam that's been used over the years there. And so we need to work to get answers. I filed legislation to create a health registry for individuals who have served on these military bases and to ensure that they can get health care through the VA system that we see a connection to their service in terms of PFAS exposure. I think that's an important step forward, but there's a lot more we need to do, not just for our veterans, but for the entire American public, to make sure that they're protected, that they can get the answers that they deserve, and that we look for ways to mitigate this contamination, to clean it up, and to provide for sounder regulations in the future so that we don't see these kind of situations pop up again.
I want to ask you about renewable energy. What types of renewable energy are you most interested in?
Well, in my business in Manchester, you know, we installed a number of solar panels years ago. They've paid for themselves, and the meter keeps churning on that. As a member of the Executive Council, we looked at ways at investing in renewables from solar projects to geothermal to biomass projects. I've gotten to know folks in the forest products industry, and biomass is seeing a lot of pressure. We've seen a number of plants go offline, and that's deeply concerning to me. That's because that's an important part, not just of our energy mix, but of the economy, particularly of northern New Hampshire. There's a great potential for offshore wind in our state, and you know, I think there's an exciting thought that we can power most of New England with the wind that's in the Gulf of Maine. And I think we need to explore that idea more thoroughly and see how New Hampshire can be a part of that solution.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the opioid crisis, because the federal government has sent to New Hampshire quite a bit of money to deal with this issue. I wanted to ask you, how do you measure success when it comes to fighting the opioid crisis? Is it the amount of money? Is it something about the way we use money? Is it something else? How do you measure success?
I believe we need an infrastructure, and we've just begun to build out an infrastructure that's going to allow us to address this in a comprehensive way and to ensure that the supports are there many years into the future. We have to realize we're not going to turn the corner on this crisis overnight, and that the picture of addiction is one that's dynamic. It's going to be changing over time. Where we mostly saw a heroin epidemic in, you know, 2012, 2013, it became a fentanyl epidemic. We're seeing crystal meth on the rise in New Hampshire today. And we need to make sure that individuals have access to care, to substance use disorder treatment services, that there are recovery programs that are accessible to them, that we have a strong healthcare workforce and drug and alcohol counselors and recovery coaches that are available. So we need to build out this system more fully. That depends on the federal funding to continue. So we have to continue to fight to make sure those dollars come to New Hampshire, because they're being put to a good use. The hub and spoke model holds a great deal of promise. It's also going to allow us to measure outcomes in a more substantial way, so that we're going to get that data, we're going to see where the dollars are best being spent, and what approach makes the most sense. A lot's been said around medication-assisted treatment, and the recent money is going to allow us to expand the number of individuals that can prescribe MAT. That's really important. So we do need a little bit of everything. We need more prevention. We need more support for law enforcement to interdict the drugs that are coming into our state. But I think by and large, we're seeing a system that is maturing right now, and we need to continue to support it. Nothing is more important than individuals having access to health care, because when they access health care, whether it's you know, a private plan or Medicaid expansion, that means the bill is paid, and that means a provider can come in and can look to create or expand services in a community. And so that's a really important vehicle for us to be able to address this too.
So is there legislation that we don't yet have that we need to, as you say, expand access to the people who need it?
You know, there are a number of bills that have been proposed in past Congresses. We're seeing some more in this Congress. I'm part of the bipartisan opioid task force. We have monthly meetings where we discuss legislative proposals. I have one around Narcan and first responders. We're actually seeing some reports around the country where first responders are being charged more for their insurance because they're carrying Narcan. And we don't want to do anything at this point in time to disincentivize people from carrying Narcan. So that's an important bill that I'm bringing forward. But there are a number of different ideas that I think can help us address this. But as I said, at a basic level, New Hampshire didn't have the type of supports we needed when the cheap drugs started hitting the streets several years ago. We were left incapable of dealing with this crisis. We've taken many steps forward. And I think funding is the key thing that we need from the federal government to make sure that we can maintain and grow our infrastructure.
One big complaint with respect to healthcare is that the low Medicaid reimbursement rates. Is there anything the federal government can do about this?
Sure. I mean, we can certainly work with states on this. This has been an issue that I've heard a great deal about over the last many years. We need to make sure that we're not seeing anyone leave this space who is providing care, who does have beds available because of low reimbursement rates. I'll continue to talk with folks at the state level about how we can best address that.
Well, we've got a lot more to talk about and some time to do it, and we'd love to have listeners weigh in on the conversation as well. If you've got a question for Congressman Chris Pappas, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to talk about infrastructure. We'll talk about Medicare for All. We'll talk about foreign policy after a break. Again, give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-800-892-6477. More after a break. This is NHPR. Today on The Exchange, Democratic Congressman from New Hampshire's 1st District, Chris Pappas. We've been talking about his work in Congress in his first 5 months. We'll also talk about what's to come. Your questions are welcome. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. Just search using NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Congressman Pappas, quick question about infrastructure. In a tweet last month, you said, "I'm eager to get to work to make serious investments in New Hampshire infrastructure." So specifically, what investments are you ready to make?
Well, our committee is really eager to see a big bill move forward. And we're actually on a couple of tracks right now. One is the need to address surface transportation, our roads and bridges and rail systems. The FAST Act that provides funding for roads and bridges expires in 2020, and New Hampshire would see a significant cut if it's not reauthorized or we don't come up with a replacement for it. So that's one area where it's absolutely essential that we make something happen. And in doing so, I'm interested in ensuring that New Hampshire gets a bigger piece of the pie. We're 50 out of 50 in terms of all the states, what they receive back from Washington in federal highway aid. We can do better than that. We've got more lane miles, more people, more area than Vermont, for instance, but we get about half as much federal funding. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, so we're looking into that. In addition to that, we'd like to see more money go toward bike and pedestrian projects that can really help enhance the quality of life, and there's a great deal of interest at the local level for those types of projects in New Hampshire, and ensure that our state can trade toll credits. Right now, we have a great turnpike system. We develop these things called toll credits that can be used as an offset for federal funding match requirements on highway projects around the state. If we were able to trade those with other states, we'd be able to leverage those dollars even further. And so that's a provision that I'm looking to get into that surface transportation bill. The second track is ensuring that we have a really broad big bill around infrastructure. You've seen the talks at the White House where the leadership has been there. They've settled on a $2 trillion price tag.
Although the president did not want to attend that meeting.
Well, the first meeting, they came up with a price tag. The meeting where they were going to talk about the hard question, which is the pay-fors, was the one where the president walked out. It's really important that we look at infrastructure broadly in terms of what we can do for our water systems, wastewater treatment, broadband access. Those are really important questions for communities across New Hampshire. And I'm eager to be a part of those discussions in our committee. There's really strong bipartisan support to get something done in both areas, both the surface transportation and the bigger infrastructure bill. And I think Congress, if left to its own devices, is going to come up with something. I'm hopeful the president will rejoin the negotiations and really be a part of a permanent agreement. He needs to be in order to make this work. And as we saw during the shutdown, he has the ability to blow up a deal at the 11th hour. And I think if he's engaged along the way, it's less likely that'll happen.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Arthur in Manchester. Arthur, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm interested in knowing, last week there was an announcement made that all of the biomass plants in northern New Hampshire will be closing, and I'm wondering where that energy source is where that energy is going to come from now on, and, you know, what kind of an environmental impact that will have.
Arthur, thanks very much for the call. So, Congressman Pappas, question about biomass in the North Country.
Well, I'm pretty disturbed at the news there. And as you know, there was legislation that was making its way through the State House last year that the governor vetoed, which would have provided support for the biomass industry. There was an override of the governor's veto. And, you know, we need a quicker decision from FERC in terms of what this all means. And we've actually sent off a letter with the rest of the delegation talking about this issue because it's such an important part of our economy, a part of the way of life of the North Country. There are hundreds of jobs that are tied to these biomass plants and the forest products industry around it. So I'm concerned about it, and I'm hopeful that they can reach some kind of a conclusion where they'll put these plants back online, and our office will continue to talk with folks in the industry, people at the state level, to see what can be done.
I want to ask about healthcare policy, specifically Medicare for All. Lots of Democrats, some of them running for president, support a Medicare for All plan. Others are concerned about getting rid of private insurance entirely. They're trying to find a middle ground. With respect to healthcare overhaul, how do you think Democrats should proceed?
Well, during the past campaign, this came up quite a bit. And what I've said all along is that I think we've got to build on what we have today, which is the Affordable Care Act. And let's not kid ourselves where we are. We're at a point in time where the administration is working tooth and nail, day and night, to try to undermine the Affordable Care Act. They're in court trying to gut it and take away protections from individuals with pre-existing conditions. And it's really essential that we step up, we defend it, and we look for ways to make it work. We can do that by shoring up the healthcare exchanges, making sure that there's choice and competition, and ensuring that we also address the cost of prescription drugs. I think those are doable steps within the political limitations that we have in this particular Congress. I do support universal health care, and I think we need to make sure that we're always insisting on health care as a right and not a privilege in this country. The Affordable Care Act took us many steps in that direction, and we've been held back by governors in certain states that wouldn't implement Medicaid expansion and by an administration that is not, you know, advertising, you know, health care products and, you know, ensuring and encouraging that people sign up. I had an amendment that I attached to a bill 2 weeks ago in terms of health care and prescription drug costs that would mandate that the administration set enrollment targets for the exchanges. The Obama administration was doing it. This administration isn't, in part because I think they're not terribly concerned with more people enrolling. They would just like to see the system collapse upon itself. And I just think that's wrong. We should push politics aside, focus on where we can take steps forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about those steps forward. What would you do specifically to build on the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I'm signing on to legislation that would create a public option on the exchange and also legislation that would lower the eligibility age for Medicare. Medicare is a popular program, and I would like to see people that are near retirement age be able to buy in to the program.
So what age would you lower it to?
Well, there's a variety of different ages. One of them, which I think is a bill that we're co-sponsoring, lowers it to 50. Mm-hmm. I said during the campaign that I would support allowing anyone to be able to buy in to Medicare to pay their own way in the program or allow businesses to choose that as an option for their employees and pay the premium. We'll see how that all pans out and what legislation comes forward on it. But I think that's a space where we can have the conversation about how to give people more choice and how to potentially lower costs for individuals. We also have to look at the cost of drugs, which is just off the charts. And we need to ensure that generics can come to market more swiftly, that we have more price transparency, and that we're allowing Medicare in particular to negotiate drug costs. And there are, I think, three competing bills on that in the House right now, and I'm sure they're going to be sort of tied up into some sort of a compromise at the end of the day. But that's really important to allow for price negotiation that has the potential to lower costs for consumers.
I want to ask you about a piece of legislation that you were recently involved in, and that's the LGBTQ Serve Act. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired this?
Well, the administration's ban on transgender military service inspired it. And I just think it's a wrong-headed decision. It tells 15,000 Americans who are in uniform today that they're no longer welcome to serve their country. We have more than 100,000 transgender veterans, by the way, out there who have already completed their service. And one of the concerns I have is if these individuals are separated from their service, are they still going to be able to access care through the VA? So this would, you know, guarantee them the health care benefits that they deserve based on the service that they have done for all of us. And I think that's a small token of what we should be able to do and should be saying to these individuals who have put everything on the line to serve this country. I think it's a very, you know, disastrous decision, the ban that the administration wrote. I think it's very political in nature. It's couched in these sort of faulty arguments that military cohesion would improve if transgender individuals are banned from service, and that's just not true. That argument's been used against lots of different groups throughout history, and it's been proven wrong, and I think it's wrong again here.
I wanted to ask you about a few foreign policy things, particularly Iran. How concerned are you about rising tensions with Iran?
Well, it's a deep concern, and, you know, I was a supporter of the deal with Iran that would keep a lid on their nuclear ambitions, and it was a product of years of diplomacy in the previous administration. This administration upended it almost immediately upon taking office. And I think when individuals like John Bolton are left to lead diplomacy in a region of the world like this, we're going in a very dangerous direction. We shouldn't be going it alone. The saber rattling that's been going on by folks in the Trump administration is not helpful. And I think we should always be leaning into our alliances and to diplomacy first. At a point in time where there's no room for error.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of alliances, NATO celebrated its 70th anniversary recently, and you've expressed your commitment to this alliance. But given President Trump's fraught relationship with it, what, if anything, can Congress do to help preserve it?
Well, we had the Secretary General of NATO appear before a joint session of Congress, and he was universally warmly received. Everyone stood and applauded, appreciated what this strategic alliance has meant to the United States from the post-war years through today. It's a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy, and we've got to continue to ensure that the U.S. is a leader of that alliance, that we're supporting it, and that we're not doing anything to attack or alienate allies as this administration has done. So I think we have a job to try to put up some guardrails for this administration to ensure that the principles of our foreign policy, that cornerstone alliances like NATO aren't undermined throughout the rest of his term, and that we adhere to those institutions that are going to promote American national security interests. And NATO does it better than anything else I know of.
President Trump has been pretty vocal about his feeling that NATO members aren't contributing enough to the mutual defense. He's been especially blunt about this, but President Obama and President George W. Bush called for NATO countries to spend more. So does President Trump kind of have a point with respect to how much countries are spending?
Well, I don't think it's a wrong argument to make. I think everyone should be participating and be contributing toward our shared security interests. But it's the way he makes the argument. It's the way he, you know, stands on stage with Vladimir Putin and praises autocrats from around the world and attacks allies like Canada. This is not how a president should comport him or herself. And I think it's very disturbing to those of us who understand what's at stake. And so I hope that this president will be a little bit more selective in the language he uses, will take a step back from Twitter every now and then. I'm not naive enough to think that he'll do it, but I think we should expect more of the president of the United States.
President Trump wanted to pull all U.S. troops from Syria who were there to help defeat ISIS, but he reversed that position, agreeing to leave a small group there after pushback from members of both parties. Do you agree that leaving some Americans there is necessary?
Well, again, here, foreign policy on Twitter doesn't work. And you've got to be listening to generals, to those on your national security team, to leaders of both parties in Congress in making a decision that's appropriate for this country. And the president seems to always want to shoot first. And
well, what would you tell the president? Like, yes, you should leave some American troops there?
Well, I think there was a consensus at the moment that the U.S. strategy was working, that a U.S. presence was needed in the short term, And that it was a foolish decision to just pull up stakes and leave altogether.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider to be the top threat to American security right now?
Well, we face a number of threats, but I think the biggest strategic threat we face is the rise of Russia and China. We have a nation in Russia that is looking to subvert American democracy here at home and around the world. We have a nation in China that is ripping us off in terms of trade agreements and our intellectual property, and is a nation that poses a long-term strategic threat to the United States. So we need to make sure that we're working with our allies and partners on the world stage, that we're leaning into alliances like NATO. We need them now more than ever as a counterweight to the challenges that Russia and China pose to us.
I want to ask a question about the economy really quickly before we wrap up. The unemployment rate is lower than it's been in 5 decades. GDP is pretty strong. How much credit does the president deserve for this?
Well, we've seen a pretty linear increase in the number of individuals in the workforce from about 2009 till today. Job growth has been pretty steady over that period. I think that, you know, we need to make sure that we're reaching everyone and that everyone's participating in this economy. And we see signs all over our state that families are under pressure, that because of the high cost of college, high cost of health care, that individuals aren't able to fully provide for their families and participate in the economy. We need to make sure that we're doing more to give individuals the tools they need to succeed. So while the unemployment rate is a good sign, and I'm not sure it can go much lower than that, and certainly we'd like to invite more people who are on the sidelines of this economy to come back into the workforce, we need to also be thoughtful about how we build the workforce of tomorrow and how we ensure that middle-class families can deal with the economic pressures that exist. Affordable housing is a top concern that exists all over New Hampshire, from the seacoast on up to the Mount Washington Valley. And if individuals and families can't afford to live in a certain area, then how is a business going to recruit the talent they need to fill the jobs that they have open today or the ones they hope to create tomorrow? So that's an important concern that we need to look at. So these numbers don't fully capture all that's happening across our economy and all the pressures that families are facing.
Really quick final question for you, Congressman Pappas. Will you be running again in 2020?
I certainly will be running again in 2020. You know, 2 years isn't long enough to be able to ensure that, you know, we're moving things in the right direction. And I hope to continue to lean into issues around veterans' health care and transportation and ensure that I'm being responsive to the needs of the people of New Hampshire. So I hope once all said and done at the end of this 2 years that I'll have another two to begin to make a bigger difference over time.
Well, Congressman Chris Pappas, thank you very much for speaking with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
This has been The Exchange. And remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Peter Biello. Laura Canoy will be back tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.